This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
When the parasha starts with the, as it is named in fact, Acharei Mos, dealing with the time after the death of the Bnei Aharon, an event which took place in Parsha Shmini, where the two sons of Aharon die for reasons that aren't altogether clear. A number of different reasons are given for it while they're bringing a korban, while they approach to bring a korban. But one of the views in Chazal is that the reason for their death was either that they had had some wine to drink immediately prior to their approaching the Mishkan, not that they were drunk, Chas v'Shalom, not at all, but that they had drunk wine, or according to others, that the fact that they had drunk wine clouded their judgment in certain issues, and that is based on the prohibition for the drinking of wine, which is stated in Parsha Shmini immediately after we're told of the death of the Bnei Aharon, where the Torah says, Vayedaber Hashem el Aharon leimer, and Hashem said to Aharon, saying, Yayin v'sheichar al tesht. Yayin and sheichar you may not drink, atol v'onecha itoch, you and your sons with you, v'voyachem el oihal moed, when you come into the oihal moed, v'los amusa, so that you don't die. And it's from there that we learn that the reason for their death must have been that they had drunk wine. Chukas oilon v'dore seichem, a permanent law for all generations. This will enable you with more clarity to distinguish between that which is holy and that which is secular, between that which is tamei and that which is tahor. And to decide for Bnei Yisrael all matters of the laws which Hashem has given to them by the hand of Moshe. Now this law of Yayin v'sheichar al tesht, the word sheichar is not altogether clear. Is sheichar another drink? Does yayin v'sheichar mean wine and sheichar, which is some other form of alcoholic drink such as beer, which is the way the Ibn Ezra learns it? Sheichar is ha'osui b'min chito, or yidavashu, tamorim. It's an alcoholic drink made from wheat, or from honey, or from dates. So it would include virtually all the alcoholic spirits and drinks. It would include beers and whiskies and things like that. That would be included in sheichar. In which case the instruction is yayin v'sheichar al tesht. You may not drink wine or any other alcoholic beverage. But according to Rashi, yayin v'sheichar yayin derech shichruso. The sheichar is not a separate drink. Sheichar comes from the word shikor, and the. It does not mean wine and any other drink, any other intoxicating drink. It means yayin v'sheichar, meaning yayin drunk in an intoxicating manner may not be used before you come into the Beis HaMikdash, which means that if you dilute it a little bit or you sip it instead of drinking it all in one go, that would be in order. So according to Rashi, sheichar is a qualification of the prohibition of drinking wine, but it is specifically wine which is prohibited, not other alcoholic drinks. According to the Ramban, other alcoholic drinks are learned from other places. According to others, it might be that Rashi doesn't learn the prohibition of other alcoholic drinks. Of course, one isn't allowed to come into the Mishkan under the influence of alcohol. We're not talking about that. We're talking about having had a small measure of an alcoholic drink before coming into the Beis HaMikdash, into the Mishkan. Even a small measure of wine, a revius of yayin, drunk at one go, undiluted, prohibits the Kohen from functioning in the Mishkan, even if it's had no obvious effect whatever on his judgment or his sobriety. But if he's even as Derech Shichruso, and that's how Rashi would seem to learn that this is a prohibition simply for wine, that there's a din that a Kohen may not have wine before he comes into the Mishkan, which means again that from this pasuk alone the problem is not the intoxicating effect. There's something in wine inherently. Other intoxicating drinks he could drink. He could have a little beer or a little bit of whiskey in terms of this posuk, but he cannot have a little bit of wine in terms of this posuk, even if it doesn't affect his clarity of thinking at all. Why not? What is there about wine that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants to exclude from the kohanim in the temple service? We use wine on the korbanos, we use yayin for nesochim, but not at the kohanim. The kohanim should not use wine. It's interesting that there is a view in Chazal that the Eitz Hadas was a vine, that the tree of knowledge was a grapevine. In which case, the prohibition of eating from the tree of knowledge implied that the Ribbono Shel Olam ideally, initially, before the Chet of Adam HaRishon, didn't want wine to be kosher. In fact, that's the only thing he didn't want to be kosher, really, in the meat as well, they didn't have. But at that time, the only halacha then was, there was going to be only one law. And instead of the usual way we say, what was the law that Adam was commanded not to eat of the tree of knowledge? Let's not talk, say, esoterically, let's talk simply and say, according to the Man D'Oma, according to the view that it was grapes, which explains a lot of things, as we're going to see. One of the things that explains is how Adam fell for it. He saw a juice, he was given a juice, he wasn't given a... she gave him a cup of wine, she didn't give him a grape, he didn't recognize it. According to others, she did tell him where it came from. Whatever the case may be, it explains a lot of difficult things. And it's a view which is prevalent in Chazal. That the Eitz HaDa'as was wine. In that case, we've got to say, the one commandment that mankind was given, only one commandment. Don't forget, this wasn't just for Adam HaRishon, this was for all of mankind. There was one commandment that mankind was given at the beginning of the creation. And that was no wine. That's all. And that creates a difficulty for us to understand. Number one, why was that so serious? Why no wine? And if it is so serious, why did wine become kosher afterwards? If wine is so destructive that the one single mitzvah that God gave mankind was not to touch wine, after man made the mistake and did take wine, took it once, but why did it become kosher afterwards? If a person eats chazer, that doesn't make chazer kosher afterwards. If a person is mechallel Shabbos, it doesn't mean he's allowed to be mechallel Shabbos afterwards. You don't disband the halacha because a person, no matter who the person is, was over that halacha once. What kind of halacha was this? Mimon of Shach. Either way, if God didn't want man to drink wine, then it should have remained in Israel all the time. And if God did want man to drink wine, why didn't he give it in the first place? But the first thing we see is that it was the intention of the Ribbono Shel Olam that man would not be permitted to drink wine. And so we're going to have to engage in a little analysis this evening as to what wine is. What is so unique about wine that Hashem didn't want it in the first place, and that he didn't want it in the Mishkan at all? But it already gives us a little bit of insight as to why he didn't want it in the Mishkan, because the Mishkan is a small model of the world as it should have been. A small model of the world in its state of perfection. A model of the world as it would have been had Adam not sinned in the first place. And as such, again, it fits in if we're going to assume that the vine was the Eitz HaDa'as, was the tree that was not permitted to be eaten of, then it makes sense that Hashem should say, not that the Kohen shouldn't come in and intoxicated. That's a different question. But it is that there should be no wine drinking in the Mishkan, just as there was to have been no wine drinking in the world according to the original plan. That begins to make sense. The first thing we need to deal with is, why was Yain called the Eitz HaDa'as? If wine is so destructive, why was it called the tree of knowledge? It should have been called the tree of drunkenness, the tree of abandon, the tree of Hefkerus. Why was it called Eitz HaDa'as, the tree of knowledge? The second thing we're going to need to discuss is David HaMelech saying in Boruch Yinafshi that the Yain Yisamach Levav Enosh, that wine makes people glad, it makes people happy. And David HaMelech is saying that very positively. It's not that it's a negative thing, he's saying that is the role of wine, that is the use. Lechem Levav Enosh Yisar, just as bread satisfies the man's heart, so wine gladdens a man's heart. And it's something we're allowed to use under certain circumstances. So we see these positive and negative attributes of wine, which has caused many other religions to be very confused as to what the role of wine is. Is it something very holy that is used in sacramentally, in services, or is it something very profane that shouldn't be used at all? And different religions handle it in different ways. Why was it called Eitz HaDa'as? Explains the Sipurnu. Das doesn't mean das in the sense of knowledge. Das means in the same sense as it is used in the Torah, where it says, "V'ha'odom yodo es chavo ishtoi," and man knew, he understood, chavo, his wife. What does that mean? That's the Torah's refined way of saying they had sexual relations. But the word the Torah chooses to use is yoda, he knew her. What does that word yoda mean? Therefore explains the Sipurnu. Eitz HaDa'as means may see lo seis lev. It arouses one to apply oneself to become interested in, to become attracted to. So what does Eitz Hadas Toivara mean? The tree which arouses man to become attracted to good and evil. Ela Toivahara. That's the same as Vahodom Yoda. Noshan Leiv Oleo. He noticed his wife. He became attracted to his wife. Umizeh Nikro Hakoroiv Moido. And so a relative is called in Tanakh sometimes a Moido, somebody known to one. It's a funny thing to say. Moido, that implies an acquaintance. Why do we call a Korov, a relative, a Moido? It's more than that. No, says the Sipunu. Moido is the closest form of acquaintance. It's used between a husband and wife. There is no closer form of human relation than Yoda. When we're using Yoda in the sense of connectivity and attractiveness, then Yoda is the ultimate of closeness, the ultimate of intimacy. And so, Eit Hadas Tov V'Ra means that tree which made man become intimate with Tov and Ra. And what does Tov V'Ra mean? Explains the Sipurna. Livchir he'orev afal pishi yazik, v'limois habilti orev afal pishi yoyel. To choose the pleasant even though it's harmful, and to despise the useful even though it's and to despise the unpleasant even though it's useful. Sorry, again. To choose the pleasant even though it's useless or harmful, and to despise the unpleasant even though it's useful. So until this time, says the Sipurnu, man's decisions were based on one thing only, and that is what is right and what is wrong, what is good for man and what is bad for man. There was no other issue. There was nothing to confuse him. Pleasure was introduced for the first time when they ate from the Eitz Hadas. So now we get a completely different perspective on what the Eitz Hadas was. The Eitz Hadas was a glass of wine. And that was the first time man became exposed to an experience which was extremely pleasant but not beneficial. And having been exposed to that, that changed his whole purity of being, and it changed the whole breed. Up until that time, whatever man experienced as pleasant was good. Whatever was unpleasant was bad. There was absolute clarity. That's why he didn't need any other mitzvahs. He could use his instincts. Because whatever was bad was unpleasant. Whatever was good was pleasant. There was no difference between the two. It was in the taste of wine, if we're going to continue our line of treating the Eitz Hadas as the vine, it was in the taste of wine that for the first time man tasted something created by Hashem, which was enormously pleasant to experience and very harmful too. And that's what Hashem didn't want man to experience. That confusion between that which is pleasant and that which is good, Hashem wanted to protect man from. As we try to protect our children from, as long as we can and as far as we can, because that introduces the origins of moral confusion. Now it becomes difficult to decide. It would be very easy to decide what to do if one was attracted only to the good and was repelled by anything which was bad and harmful. But it's not so. The child likes you. You get parents who don't want their children to have sweets. Well, the child mustn't learn to have sweets. So you give them this health food, give them nuts and raisins instead and so on. The children quickly learn. It doesn't take long for the child to learn that the wool is being pulled over his eyes and that there's some nice things out there that his parent isn't letting him have. Why not? Because they're not healthy. But if they're not healthy, why are they so delicious? That's the result of the chet of Adam HaRishon. That's the beginning, the child's first, when the child puts his first sweet, his first unhealthy sweet into his mouth. That's the first time that the child tastes the consequences of Adam's chet. That there is such a thing, and that's the beginning of the working of his Yetzer Hara. Now he's got to make choices. His mother says, don't have them, they're bad. He disobeys his mother and tries them, and they're delicious. And now comes a problem. Is the mother a liar? Or do we just disagree on what's good and bad? Mother thinks that sweets are bad, I think sweets are good, and so now what happens? And then there's a clash of wills. That's all the child's first confrontation with the consequences of the chet of Adam HaRishon. The need to have to discern between what is pleasant and what is good. And if you look at all the confusion that takes place afterwards, if you open any newspaper, if you look at any advertisement, you will see, not just advertisements, but articles too, if you look at anything, you will see, you can analyze virtually every event in the world, every destructive and negative event in the world, as a result of this confusion between that which is pleasant and that which is good. What would the world have looked like if there was no wine, if wine remained treif? What would the world have looked like? So The Medrash gives us a bit of a picture as to what the world would have looked like. Based on the Pasuk in Mishle, comparing wine to the Tzifoin. Tzifoin is a kind of a snake. The Malbim explains that when this snake bites, the person who's been bitten not only suffers the effects of the poison, but it becomes infectious. And if he has contact with other people, then that infection can be spread to the other people too. And the Medrash goes on and gives a couple of examples. Ma tzifoin ze mafrish bein miso l'chaim. This tzifoin separates between life and death. A person who has been bitten by the tzifoin is marked for death, and people keep away from him. People don't come near him. It's a little bit like AIDS. He's not part of living society. He's separated. That's the effect of the tzifoin. Kach hifrish hayayin. Wine does the same thing. Ben Odom l'Chava. First example the Medrash gives is between Adam and Eve, between Odom and Chava, separated between them. In what sense? The whole, one can take this on many levels, but let's take it on perhaps the most obvious or the most important level, is that it would appear that the whole process of a woman's cycle and the consequence of the laws of family purity were partially the consequence of the chet of Adam HaRishon too. So that there was a period as a result of that chet where husband and wife are not permitted to have physical relations, that was a result of the chet of Adam HaRishon. We can take it at another level too. As we know, the Chazal tell us that Adam and Chava were originally one being. They were created as one unit, and they were later separated. According to some, they were separated as a consequence of the chet. Had they not sinned, had Adam and HaRishon not sinned, then Adam and Chava would have remained one unit. Be that as it may, in both cases, however you want to learn it, it is the wine, the drinking of that wine from the Eitz Hadas, which caused Hashem to change the relationship between man and woman from the relationship from a non-sexual relationship, in a sense. That's really what it was. Man and woman were two equal beings, and there was no Yetzer Hara. There was no pleasure in sexual relationships for its own purpose, because there was no such thing as pleasure that wasn't good. So the only pleasure there was in family building, that's all. And that was the relationship. And the only purpose of man and woman living together, whether as one unit or as two units, however we want to take it, was to build family life. And the pleasure and the excitement of that intimacy was family construction. There was no other interest. There was no other benefit. There was the benefit of companionship. There was the benefit of chavrusa. But they operated like two equals. They operated in the most intimate form of companionship and friendship, without all the sexual undertones and pressures and all sorts of other things. That didn't exist at all. That was what wine did. Wine created, and it wasn't the wine directly, but it was through the existence of yayin that the Ribbono Shel Olam then separated man and woman. And we must read this not just as Adam and Chava, but separated man and woman into two different, separate sexual identities, which then created all the subsequent problems that exist as a result of that, and pleasures. And that's one of the things we're going to have to try and sort out this evening. That together, as a result of this chet, as a result of this sin, there is the introduction of certain pleasures that didn't exist before. In a sense, maybe we're better off. We need to analyze that too. But the pressures and the destructiveness of sexual interplays and forces between man and woman did not exist before, nor did the pleasures. Different pleasures existed, the pleasures of building families. Earlier on, the Medrash says, based on another pasuk in Mishle in the same perek, Al tere yayin ki yis adem. Don't come to wine, don't get close to wine, ki yis adem, because it makes one red, is the simple translation. Mal ki yis adem explains the Medrash, what is ki yis adem? Ki yis ave ledam nido ledam zivu. It creates in a man a desire to transgress the laws of family purity. You can have a man and a woman who are living together, and she says to him at a critical moment, we have a problem, Nido, and now he needs the self-discipline and the Yiras Shemayim to say, no, okay, that's it. And if he's under the influence of wine, that could be very difficult to do. So we see that on the one hand, wine introduced the barriers between man and wife, or between man and woman, and wine used today is used to obscure those barriers and to break those barriers down. Let's go a little further, we'll come back to it in a moment.
Just as the tzifon snake separates people from life and death, kach hifrish hayayin bein noach levonov liavdus.
So wine was responsible for racial alienation. I'm now paraphrasing the medrash slightly. In the first medrash, we learned about sexual alienation, the differences between man and woman, the separation of man and woman into two separate sexual identities, and the consequential oppression isn't quite the right word of the female sex by the male sex. There is such a thing, and it is problematic, and it needs to be dealt with, but its origins are also with that chet. That's where it started. Your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. There is a problem there. The sexes are not equal, and that creates certain social problems. There is an alienation between the sexes of man and woman, and there is a racial alienation. Where's the racial alienation? Anti-Semitism is not a racial alienation. That's an ideological difference. People don't like the Jews because of what the Jews stand for, not because they're Jewish. If the Catholics and the Protestants are fighting in Ireland, that's a philosophical and a religious dispute. It develops into all sorts of political areas too, but it's not a racial dispute. They're part of the same race. The dispute between the Jews and the Arabs is not a racial dispute. We're part of the same race. We're all B'nai Shem. They're not two races. It's two nations. It's a religious dispute that is at the basis of it. The differences between Christians and Arabs is a religious dispute. It's not a racial dispute. There's only one dispute that is really racially based, and that's blacks and whites. And as we see this week in the press, it's not only in South Africa that racialism exists. It has existed all over and will exist all over. And if we take the view that the black people are descended from Ham, that the African nations are descended from Ham, then we trace the origins of racial alienation back to Ham, who was the first nation of slaves. So the concept of an inferior race, if you want to call it that, originated then. Ham was cursed by Noach to being an inferior race, a race of slaves. And whether we're going to say that the African people are descended from Ham or they're not, somewhere or other, that concept of inferior race developed for the first time as a result of Ham. And what was it that was the result? Ham, Canaan, what was it that caused that result? We might think that the only alienation that took place and that was corrected by the halachas of family purity and other such laws are the laws that govern heterosexual relationships. But it was also necessary within each of the sexes to create barriers. And those are the prohibitions of homosexual relationships, which according to one view in Chazal is the barrier that Ham broke down, for which he was punished with inferior race. And what caused him to break down those barriers? Because he saw his father drunk. Why was his father drunk? Because he drank wine. Again, wine created a circumstance. Wine wasn't responsible. What was responsible for that curse? The responsibility for that curse was Ham's actions towards his father. But what created the environment in which those actions could take place? Wine made it possible. The fact that Noah had become intoxicated put him into a state where his son could do to him what he did, the consequence of which was ultimately the creation of an inferior race. And as unpopular as such a statement is today, that's what the Torah tells us. There was, at that moment, the creation of an inferior race. And we must never forget that from that inferior race, some great people came, such as Eliezer Eved Avrom. Eliezer was an exceptionally great man, an enormous Talmid Chochem, close to Avraham. If it weren't that he was from that nation, his daughter could have married Yitzchok. They were close. He was an extremely close Talmud of Avraham, much closer than Avraham's blood relations was Eliezer. So when we talk about an inferior race, that does not mean we're talking about inferior individuals. We're talking about an entire nation starting at the disadvantage of being affected by the curse of Noach. That's what we mean by an inferior race. But one race being alienated from the rest of humanity by virtue of their race only was a result of wine. So now we have the separations building into society. As a result of wine, men and women become two entities, and Ham and Canaan and their descendants and the rest of humanity become two entities. And the Medrash goes on. Yafrish, just as the poisonous snake separates, kach yifrish hayayin bein loit livenoisov lemamzerus. So also, the wine separated between Lot and his daughters. And if I'm not mistaken, the same midrash that appears in Megillas Esther, the separation there is not between Lot and his daughters, but between the daughters and their children, for Mamzerus. What happened there? You'll remember the daughters thought that there was nothing left of humanity. There were no men for them to marry. They had no children. There were just three people left in the world, Lot and the two daughters. And so they gave Lot wine to drink, and they had relations with him, from which Ammon and Moab resulted. But of course, those two children were Mamzerim. They were bastards in terms of halacha, because they were the result of an incestuous relationship. So now we see, not only are there laws that institute barriers between the sexes, there are laws that institute barriers even within each sex, and there are laws, and then you might say, okay, so that's for strangers, but for the family itself there are no barriers. No, even within the barriers there are laws of within the family there are laws of incest. Within the family there are also barriers. And wine broke down those barriers too, and created Ammon and Moab, who were Mamzerim. So the interesting thing is that what results from here is permanent cases of alienation. In the case of Adam and Chava, alienation between the sexes. In the case of Noach, alienation between nations. In the case of Lot, alienation of Mamzerim, social alienation, the concept of Mamzerim, of children who can't marry, they're Jewish and all the rest of it. In that case, it wasn't yet a question of being Jewish, but the concept of Mamzerus separates them. They remain permanently separated, just as Avodim, just as slaves, descendants of Ham and Canaan, are permanently separated from the rest of humanity, just as men and women are permanently separated. These are separations that cannot be overcome. A non-Jew can convert and he can become a Jew, but a Mamzer cannot become an Ois Mamzer, and an Eved doesn't very easily become, or a descendant of Ham doesn't become Ois a descendant of Ham, and a woman doesn't become a man, and a man doesn't become a woman, despite all the weird and wonderful things one reads about. It doesn't happen. One stays either one or the other. That's how it is. And these separations, these alienations within mankind, were all created as a result of that original drinking of wine, and it is wine that crossed those barriers in each case. Whereas the Sipurna says, what does wine do? It allows the person to pursue what he finds immediately pleasurable, irrespective of the enormity of the consequences. It enables him to think, to blot out the thought of the consequences while he pursues his own pleasure. And finally, the last case is in this midrash. Ma tzifin ze mafrish bein miso l'chaim, kach yifrish hayayin bein arin uvonov l'miso. That alcohol, wine, can even bring about the ultimate separation between life and death, physical life and death. Just as we see in the case of the Bnei Aaron, they had something to drink before they went into the Mishkan, and they died and became permanently separated from their father. And of course, in a sense, we see today as well how, just in terms of drinking and driving, how quite apart from breaking the barriers of the social barriers, wine in itself can cause immediate death. And so we see a couple of examples given by the Medrash that if
let's say, by the drinking of wine created an environment in which barriers were broken, the consequence of which was absolute alienation. And that really is the chiddush of this medrash. And that is the one would normally think that alienation is created by barriers. This medrash teaches us that alienation is created by the removal of barriers. It was Adam and Chava who tried to remove barriers by drinking the wine. It created a barrier. It was Noach's son, it was Noach through the drinking of wine, the barriers were broken and homosexuality was committed, the breaking of barriers. What was the result of that? The creation of a nation surrounded by permanent barriers. Lot and his daughters used wine in order to break down barriers. What was the result of that? The creation of individuals who were permanently barriered in laws of Mamzerus. The children of Aaron used a little bit of wine to feel still closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. What was the result of that? Permanent alienation. They died. They were separated absolutely from their father. And so, if we look at it now, we say, what would the world have looked like without wine? The world would have been a world in which barriers were not necessary. Man and woman would have been one unit, and they would have functioned one unit, whether physically or emotionally. That's how they would have functioned, as one unit. And there would have been no need for barriers, because where there's oneness, there is no need for barriers. And since there would have been no interest in that which is pleasurable when it's not good, when its consequences are not good, all these other things that wouldn't have had to be, all the other barriers which the Torah has had to create, whether in the areas of homosexuality or heterosexuality and many other areas where we have to be told, although it's pleasant, it's not allowed, that would not have had to be there if man felt no attractiveness to that which wasn't pleasant. So it was through the drinking of wine that barriers had to be created. But now comes the interesting idea, and that is, it's through the creation and the maintenance of those barriers that intimacy can be created. Before the drinking of the wine, before the chet of Adam HaRishon, intimacy existed without barriers, because Adam and Chava were one. Now that barriers have been created, we have two options. The wine option, to break down the barriers and try and find intimacy, or the Torah system of maintaining the barriers and finding intimacy within those barriers. And the Midrash gives us these examples to show how the efforts to break down the barriers ultimately simply stiffened and hardened the barriers of alienation and created much worse barriers between people that could never be broken down at all. And let us understand that in a very simple sense. David Shaw told me, he was reading an article by some Rosh Yeshiva in America, who was saying how you have to be careful when it comes to Pesach and you're talking to non-religious people. The freedom that you are describing, our concept of Pesach freedom, this blissful freedom that you're describing, is for the ordinary non-religious, ordinary secular person, is a description of hell. It's the same place. What do we talk about? Chayrus, Ein Chayrus Ela Torah, that Chorus Halalucha, is that we're talking about the freedom of Torah worship, the freedom of commitment to Torah. To a secular person, can you imagine anything more hellish than having been committed to a discipline like the Torah? So one has to realize that although one is using the same word, one is actually describing opposite emotions to different people. And what are those opposite emotions? The same as we're dealing with here. Is freedom achieved through the wine route of breaking down the barriers, and then we can create intimacy and feel free? If we've broken down the fences, we're free and open. Or is freedom created through the construction of those fences? Let us look at a few examples, and we should see it quite clearly. How free are a man and a woman to express themselves openly and freely? Let's take an extreme case. A man and woman who are both married but not to one another meet one another. They have something to talk about. They're doing business together, whatever. How free are they really to express themselves in an open society, in a society not governed by the laws of the Torah? How free are they? What's going through each of their minds? Let's take an easier case to start with. You, let's take a man and a woman who are not married to anybody. How free are they to really express themselves? What is each one thinking all the time? If I say this, what will she think and how will she interpret it and what will she think of me? And what kind of messages is it given out? Is that going to make her think that I'm interested in her? I don't want her to think that I'm interested in her because I'm not interested in her. Or I really am interested in her, but the last thing I want her to do is to know that I'm interested in her. So I should say, and so the talk starts going on and each one's working out, playing the most intriguing games to do what? To maintain their privacy. That's really what they're trying. The guy is saying, or the girl is saying, I'm terribly interested in this guy. If he would propose to me now, gosh, I would faint with joy. Without a question. And he doesn't quite propose. He says to her, are you doing anything this Motzei Shabbos after the shir? And she says, this Motzei Shabbos, of course I'm for the next 6 weeks I'm busy. You want to make a date? We can go out in 6 weeks' time. And she sits at home all by herself, this Motzei Shabbos, and she sits by herself all over herself. And she waits for 6 weeks. What's the game? What is she trying to do? Just to preserve her privacy. She doesn't want him to know that she's interested. She's very wise. Because she, knowing men quite well, will realize that as soon as he realizes how interested she is, he'll cease to be interested. So he keeps him playing. But what kind of game is it? And then he starts pursuing her and he waits his 6 weeks, and so the game develops and they start developing a bit of a relationship. And it starts coming a time where it's time for commitment. What does he start doing? A commitment. I don't want her to think that I'm ready for a commitment, responsibility, and why? No. So he starts again. What is it? Why can't they just talk openly? Why can't she say on that first date, not only aren't I doing anything this Motzei Shabbos, but I would like nothing more than to spend all the Motzei Shabbos for the rest of my life and all the days in between with you. That's what I would like most of all. Why can't she say that? She knows she'll doom herself if she says that. And yet, where there are barriers. Before we come to the barriers, let's take the other extreme of the example now. A man and a woman both married to somebody else. How do they interrelate? Are they free to express themselves? Of course not. And if the woman is wearing something really attractive, the most beautiful jersey she's wearing, can he feel free and comfortable to say to her, you know, you're wearing a beautiful jersey? Can he say that? Can he say, you're looking magnificent today? Can he say that free and comfortably? Without thinking, my goodness, what will she think if I'm saying that? Yeah. She'll start interpreting it and who knows what. So he can't say that. And can she say to him, you didn't even notice my beautiful jersey today? She also can't. It's going over boundaries. But if the boundaries are very clear, if the boundaries are clearly imposed, does it get a little easier or a little more difficult? If the couple that are going out are working through a shadchan and the rules are clear, you don't go out if you're not interested, and if you're going out it's for the purpose of investigating whether this is a potential marriage, anything else is considered misleading unless it's made absolutely clear that that's the basis of it and that's the reason for it. If that's how it is, and the shadchan phones up the young lady and says, I have a very fine chos and a very fine young man who's interested in you. As I know it's short notice, it's immediately after Shabbos, I know you go to the Motzei Shabbos shir, but are you by any chance free afterwards? Can you then, can the young lady then say quite happily, as it so happens, I am free. And if you think he's suitable, I would like to make some inquiries. If it's so, in fact, I would very much like to go out with him this evening. Anything wrong with that? No problem. There's no game playing. Why is there no game playing? Because the rules are clear. You're imposing a rigorous system which liberates the spirit in a way that all the freedom doesn't liberate it. And where the rules are very clear, is it a little less easy or a little bit more easy? If the rules are absolutely clear that there's no way that this man can be interested in this woman because he's married and she's married, and they're living in a society where the sanctity of the marriage and the family is absolutely unquestioned. And if he does say, that's a lovely jersey you're wearing today, is there any place for her misconstruing it? No, there isn't. It's a little easier. Whether it's the right thing to say or not, we're not getting into, but it's a little easier than it is in a society when the barriers are obscure. She can't start figuring out what are the messages. The messages are very simple. He's complimenting your jersey because he wants to cheer you up. That's all. That's the message. It has no other meaning whatever. It cannot have any other meaning whatever because the barriers are clear. There's an understanding. And so it is in the barriers between people interrelating with each other. If there was clear barriers between in matters of ownership of property, if there was no question of one person taking something that belonged to another, imagine we lived in such a society where there's no question of one person taking what belongs to another person. Would it be necessary to put up fences and to have security systems and alarms? It wouldn't. Let's say there was the death sentence for theft. you take a needle that doesn't belong to you. Death sentence, public hanging. That's it. Without trial. Let's say that's what it is. A rigorous system of barriers. You dare not touch something which isn't yours. Would that liberate us? Or would that enslave us? It would liberate us. We could take down our fences straight away, our high walls we could take away, drop the security systems, walk in the streets at night. There would be no problem. We see that the strengthening of barriers doesn't enslave the human spirit. It frees the human spirit. And so after the Chet of Adam HaRishon, when the pleasure principle was first introduced into the experience of man, it became necessary to counteract that with barriers. There was no point in saying wine is treif, Adam, and it must remain treif from now on. Once wine has been tasted, it's too late. Once the child has tasted his first sweet, you can't tell him it's no good for you. It's not nice. It's too late. All you can now do is start building up his ability to resist it. But you can't pull the wool over his eyes anymore and tell him it's not nice. He knows it is nice. After mankind has tasted wine, you can't tell mankind that anything that is bad isn't pleasurable. He knows it is pleasurable. Very pleasurable. And so there's no point in wine becoming treif again. That purity has been destroyed forever for all of mankind. So what is left to Hashem to do? Then we have to institute barriers. Once the pleasure principle is there, then we have to institute barriers. That's the only way man can remain free, is to introduce those barriers. If there wasn't the pleasure principle, you wouldn't need the death sentence for people who are stealing. If people weren't attracted by that which was pleasurable, even though it wasn't good, they were only attracted by the good, then you wouldn't need it. People wouldn't steal from one another because it's not good to steal. You wouldn't need any punishment at all. You wouldn't need courts of law, and you wouldn't need police forces for criminal law, and you wouldn't need police forces for that. People just wouldn't steal. People wouldn't murder. People wouldn't rob. So you would be able to take down your fences even without the death sentence. You don't need physical barriers and you don't need legal barriers. But once that isn't the case, once man is attracted to try and get away with as much pleasure as he can without getting into trouble, which is what we all do. Basically, that's what man does nowadays. We will try to get as much pleasure as we can out of life without getting into trouble. Trouble from God, trouble from the Lord, trouble from the family, trouble from whoever, our bosses. But that's what we'll try and do. We do pursue pleasure. Once we're going to pursue pleasure, the only way that can be leveled out is by the institution of barriers to retain the freedom of the human spirit. And so the Ribbono Shel Olam introduces these barriers. A barrier between a man and a woman. A barrier between men and men. A barrier between Mamzerim and the rest of society, a barrier between a nation of slaves and the rest of society. All sorts of barriers have to be introduced in order to allow man to remain free, in order to allow man to be able to express himself freely. What do we do with wine? Sometimes those barriers do need to be removed a little bit. Because if we understand the barriers to their extreme, if we really understand the consequences, then the average person would become extremely oppressed and depressed. If we realize, then the human situation becomes very heavy and very tragic. If we think it through right until the end, we can become extremely pessimistic. We can become extremely negative. And so the concept of Yayin Yisamach Levav Enosh, yes, there is sometimes a need to lower the barriers a little bit, to break the barriers, to break the inhibitions a little bit, to relax, to unwind. And that is permitted within certain boundaries. But we need to know the dangers of that too. Sometimes we need to do it in Yayin Yisamach Levav Enosh. Sometimes the heart needs a little bit of upliftment, and one can have a schnapps in order to uplift oneself a little bit. It's okay. But it has to be, we have to watch what we're doing, because in effect what we're doing is dropping barriers. And if we think that the dropping of barriers are going to introduce us to human freedom, we're mistaken. The dropping of the barriers are going to introduce us to a Hollywood illusion of temporary freedom, the consequence of which is going to be unbelievable alienation thereafter, unbelievable separateness thereafter. And that's what we're dealing with today, is an enormous sense of loneliness, an enormous sense of aloneness among people. And why is that? One would think that today there should be so little of it. In a society that is so free, in a society that is governed by so few norms, people are much more lonely than they were in Victorian times. People are much more lonely today than they were in times when society was governed by all these rigorous conventions. Now privacy needs to be preserved in a home. A husband's privacy needs to be preserved. A wife's privacy needs to be preserved. And if you look at the styles of architecture even, and you look in the bedrooms and the bathrooms and all sorts of things, you realize how society thinks that you're bringing people closer by removing barriers. Open plan offices. What are open plan offices? Open plan offices is turning the office environment into the elevator. That's all. Throwing everybody together in such a way that they don't have privacy. What happens when they don't have privacy? The thought originally was better for communication. No walls. People will communicate much better. They become secretive. And it would be an interesting study to find out whether a lot of these fraud cases that have been going on in big corporations recently haven't been committed in open office environments. People become even more secretive, people become even more withdrawn within themselves as you open up the environment. And now if you look in the newspaper when they advertise homes, show homes and so on, what's one of the things they advertise as a big miler? Open plan living styles. And they start off with open plan lounges and open plan dining rooms. They take the wall down between the lounge and the dining room. Open plan. Then they take the wall down between the kitchen and the lounge and the dining room, which is something weird to understand. What is it? So while the wife's cooking, because we don't have servants as much as we used to any day now, but the housewife herself is very often, so while she's busy in the kitchen, she's not cut off from the conversation, she can carry on being part of it and so on. But is she part of it? Go into a home that has open style. What is the wife doing when she's in the kitchen and everything's sizzling and the steam's all over the place and the smells are coming into the dining room and the clatter of dishes? What happens? Does that encourage conversation? It doesn't encourage conversation in the dining room, and it doesn't encourage conversation in the kitchen. And if there are servants working in the kitchen, do they feel free to talk to each other as they work? No, because they're disturbing the people in the dining room. So nobody talks. You're back in the elevator. Open plan living. And then you go into the bedroom section, and you find the same things being happened. Bathroom en suite. We all like baths. What does bathroom en suite mean? Put the bathroom in the bedroom, and the bedroom in the bathroom. Take down the boundaries. Take down the boundaries. Remove privacy. And you'll find homes, in fact, where the bathroom is in the bedroom. It's interesting sometimes to go to the showers. It's unbelievable. Not only how people are willing to live, but they're willing to pay extra to live that way. Where you'll find bathrooms in the bedrooms without walls. Baths in the middle of the bedroom. Big thing, big yichus. What is it? A deprivation of privacy. And a belief that by taking down the walls, people will feel freer and closer to one another. Such a mistake. Such a mishugas. Take down walls between the races. Put them in the same schools. They'll feel closer to one another. They feel more distant from one another, not closer. Black Americans are now campaigning for separate schools for blacks. They feel uncomfortable. They don't feel more comfortable, they feel less comfortable. The schools need to be as good, but they're campaigning for separate schools. Where there is a difference, people want to feel that difference, and that enables them to feel free, not the removal of barriers. So it is we see the brilliance with which Chazal understood, and the Torah understands the human condition. What looks so obvious on the surface is so wrong when one analyzes it a little more deeply. We think that the removal of barriers will solve the terrible loneliness and the terrible alienation that we feel in our time. That isn't so. The terrible loneliness and the terrible alienation that we feel in our time is as a result of the removal of barriers. And it's exactly the same in our relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. As we've removed the barriers in our relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, you would think we would have become more free. You would think that a Reformed Jew is more close to God than an Orthodox Jew. And a person who's not a Jew altogether should be even closer. The less barriers there are, the less restrictions there are. It doesn't work that way. The more we felt ourselves governed by the Ribbono Shel Olam, the more we felt free to express ourselves to the Ribbono Shel Olam. The more the architects of society, just as the architects of homes and offices, have removed the barriers between ourselves and between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam, so we've had to hide more and more within ourselves, developing all sorts of psychological problems and sometimes even psychiatric problems, breaking down the barriers, breaking down the conditions for free expression of the way we really are and the way we really feel, having to live two lives, the way we feel and the way we communicate ourselves to others, which sometimes have nothing to do with one another, because that's the only way we can maintain our privacies. It's interesting that one of the cases where you're allowed to tell a lie is when your privacy is invaded. We discussed recently in the shiur, on what basis in business am I allowed to tell a lie if I'm busy negotiating for a property and the asking price for the property is R1,000,000, and I figure R1,000,000 is a little high. I'm prepared to pay R850,000. But if I go in at 850,000 rand, I know what's going to happen. We're going to land up at well over 900,000 rand, so I can't go in at 850. So I start off at 600,000 rand, and they throw me out. So I said, look, don't throw me out. 600,000 rand is too little. How much? They said, we told you 1 million. I said, look, 1 million is out of the question. I'm willing to go to 650. And so it goes on and on. You know how it works. And eventually, remember, I'm willing to go up to 850. Eventually I say 750, and that's my last offer. And the counterpart looks me in the eye and he says, you're a religious Jew. Tell me, is that your best and your last offer? What do I do? I look him straight back in the eye and I say, yes. Because you have no right to ask me that question. That's an invasion of my privacy. Because you've put me in a position where by answering that question, I'm ruining myself. And so I'm fully entitled, because you've invaded my privacy, to look you straight in the eye and say, yes, that is my best offer. And he says, I turn it down, I reject it. And then I'm fully entitled to say, as religious Jew as I am, that 850, that 750, let's make it 800 and call it a deal. And he says, but you said it wasn't. But he doesn't ask that, because he knows that that's the way one operates. Why is one allowed to operate that way? Because that was a question that invades privacy. And we sometimes do that. We ask each other questions which put one another in situations where we have no right to put the other person. And he has nothing to do. The only way he can preserve that privacy, where it's a situation where he's entitled to preserve the privacy, the only way he can do so is by lying. And that's one of the three cases where Pi Halacha one's allowed to tell a lie. One has to be very careful in making those judgments to make sure that one is in an area where one is entitled to protect one's privacy. You can't tell a lie in an area where you are being pressured to answer something where you don't have that right to protect your privacy. But where you do, that we're allowed to do. Torah is very concerned with the fact that Ein Chayrus Ela Torah and Chorus Al Aluchus, it is through the unmoving, engraved principles of Torah that govern human life, solidly, almost harshly, strictly. It's only in that strictness of the governance of Torah that the human spirit can truly be liberated to allow one another to express each other to one another the way we need to, in order to break down the internal barriers that cause so much loneliness, and to begin to relate to one another from the security of our God-made barriers, allowing ourselves to express ourselves in a human way that is free, that is open, that is warm, and one that solves that problem.